Session number 21581, Wheel 2.
Ron Apps, Reel 2.
So really, whilst we were going out in our submarines, sinking German shipping and German naval vessels for that matter, they were doing their job, we were doing ours, and we both got on with it. There was no actual sense of animosity, I don't think. I have met German prisoners, I did meet German prisoners of war. I met Italian prisoners of war in North Africa as well, and we were never in a sense of enmity between us.
What happened next to you?
I stayed with the Tyne as trainee, and then on various occasions I went to destroyers for training. I was on an HMS Bulldog for about 3 or 4 days doing a training session. And then after that, I joined HMS Inglefield, which was the flotilla leader of the I-class destroyers. And we went out with the fleet as a covering force for the fleet, which would have been battleships, cruisers and aircraft carriers. They just poked their nose out of Scapa. We're talking about a 4 or 5 day trip out just to make sure that the Admiral had got his escort vessels in the right places, covering the fleet to make sure that nobody got inside the cover and tried to torpedo them. We were doing various exercises. They did firing exercises as well with their 16-inch guns. And then we came back into Scapa and we spent some time there doing routine work. And then in the end of December, I remember we had a fantastic Christmas on the Inglefield, where we had had our Christmas dinner and generally mucked about. And then on Christmas night, we slipped anchor in just off the island of Hoy in Scapa Flow, which was the destroyer anchorage, and headed out into the North Sea. This was the Inglefield leading three other I-class destroyers. And we had noticed that each ship had something like 10 commandos aboard and wondered what they were doing. We thought, where are we going and what are we going to do? And it appeared, because the captain cleared lower deck and came down to the main seaman's mess deck, and I was off watch at that time, so I was in the background listening. And Captain Todd, who was our skipper, told us that we were going out into Norway and we were going up a Norwegian field. We actually had a Norwegian pilot aboard. We were going up a Norwegian field and we were going to blow up whale oil storage tanks and a whale oil, I suppose, processing factory. We were going to be about 30 miles up this fjord, so we had taken aboard commandos, and the idea was that if while we were up this field in the middle of the night, the Germans happened to put a boom across the field to stop us getting out again, then we were to make our way into neutral Sweden. Unfortunately, he had failed to impress upon us the fact that neutral Sweden would be something like 40, 50 miles away, and we would have to walk. And it was January 1941, which is extremely cold. January 1942, this would have been, not 1941, January 1942. But basically, the whole operation went very well indeed. I have written an article in it. We got up this field at about 3 o'clock in the morning. We finally got up to this town and just went round and round the harbour at very high speed and blew the hell out of this whale oil processing factory and set the storage tanks alight. And then, having completed the operation, came back down the field, and the Germans had not run a boom across, and so we were able to get out of the field, out into the North Sea again, where Captain Todd sent the signal to the Admiralty and to the Home Fleet, saying, the C&C, the Home Fleet, saying, this was known as Operation Kit Bag, and the signal went forth, kit bag stowed, and the laconic signal came back from the Admiralty, well stowed, and we then came back to Scapa Flow. So that was the end of that one, but a very interesting matter of, I don't know, 8 days, maybe 6 days.
What impression did the commanders themselves make on you?
Very interesting, really, because they stood on deck and fired their rifles, and the officers fired their ordinary 4.5 or 3.8 revolvers at the towners. Every time we went past the factory, they had a good firing session just to see if their marksmanship was any good.
So they weren't actually landed?
No, they didn't land at all. They were only with us to guide us into Sweden if we had to go. But a very interesting matter of about 6 days.
And no enemy opposition?
No, none at all, fortunately. We thought we were going to be, that by the time we got back into the North Sea, we'd at least get some enemy aircraft over. But we were very lucky that we had an RAF cover, and I think they scared off any of the enemy bombers, enemy fighters or bombers that were over, were likely to come over. Yes.
Was this a happy ship for you, Inglefield?
Oh, Inglefield was a very happy ship, yes. I have some very happy memories of, certainly of that Christmas celebrations. We dolled ourselves up in our best uniforms and shaved and had collars and ties on, which was very unusual for life on a destroyer, I can tell you. Most of us spent our time in roll neck pullovers. But we dressed up for Christmas lunch. We had a really good do.
Why were you so casual in a destroyer?
I think in a destroyer, because of the life it is, a very close and closed community, everybody knowing, certainly in the engine room staff, the engineer, the engine room artificers, there would have been a chief ERA and 4 watch keepers and a couple of trainees, of which I was one. We would be a very close crew. We were all trained engineers, knowing what we were doing. And down in the engine room, we knew exactly what we were doing at any given time. A very close community, and therefore very friendly. And I've never found any sense of animosity amongst any of the crews that I sailed with. I don't think there was time for that sort of thing at all.
What are your next memories?
I beg your pardon?
What are your next memories?
My next memories were leaving the Inglefield and going back to the Tyne. But I was only aboard the Tyne for a matter of a fortnight, and I joined the HMS Fury, which was a F-class destroyer, smaller than the Inglefield, because the Inglefield was a leader. But she had lost one of her ERAs that had gone over to a hospital ship, I think with appendicitis, I'm not sure. And I was, by that time, I was a qualified watchkeeper because I had qualified with my service on the Inglefield for my certificate of watchkeeping. And so I joined the Fury as a watchkeeper. And this was my first experience as a watchkeeper. And I had been on the Fury at anchor about a week in Scapa when we sailed. And the news then, we refer to it in the Navy as a buzz. The buzz went round the ship that we were heading for Russia. And we left with 2 other destroyers. I can't remember the names of the destroyers. And we headed for Iceland. and for the famous Sadie's Field, where the convoy of ships would assemble with its escort to leave for Russia. I can always remember arriving in Sadie's Field, which was about something like 5 o'clock at night, and it was getting to be a bit dull and dusky, and being very, very surprised to notice that whilst it was almost a field with very, very high sides, there was a town spread all the way around the field sides, level with the sea, and they all had their lights on. And this was the first time that I had actually come close to a town with its lights on, because naturally in England at that time, or Great Britain at that time, everything was blacked out. And here was a town in the distance where we were anchored, looking at it with all its lights on, its street lights and cars moving with their lights on. It was an experience that you remember, you know, from years and years ago, nearly 60 years ago. I can still see those street lights and the cars moving. Most intriguing. The convoy assembled. I can't remember exactly how many ships. It was something like 28 ships. But there were only two destroyers. This was the very early days of the convoy system, which was PQ-13. People have asked me, what was the reason for PQ? And I understand from articles I've read later that it was purely and simply the initials of the man in the Admiralty that used to set up the convoys. And his name was something like Peter Quick. And they called them PQ-1, PQ-2, PQ-3. Anyhow, we had two destroyers and two escort vessels. And we headed for Russia. And that in itself was quite a fantastic experience. I have written two articles on PQ-13, and it was something that will live with you for the rest of your life.
Please, could you take me through PQ-13? Step by step, in as much detail as you possibly can, please, but going from memory rather than from paper.
Pretty, in a way, horrifying, although when you've got a job to do, and then after that job you've got to get some, if you can, rest, not very penetrating, if I can use that expression. The first two or three days were fairly peaceful. We slopped along in weather which was cold, miserable and raining. And when you're in a convoy and your convoy is restricted in speed to the highest speed of the slowest member of the convoy, you're going along at something like 8 or 9 knots. A destroyer is basically designed to go at high speed. The name destroyer comes from the vessel which was designed to destroy torpedo boats, because torpedoes were developed before destroyers. And the word, in actual fact, is a torpedo boat destroyer. And it is designed for high speed, and therefore slopping along at 9 knots is not conducive to remaining unseasick. On a depot ship, there is a room which is known as the RPY room, where they set compasses and various other devices on a destroyer that have to be repaired and tested against life on a destroyer. And RPY is roll, pitch and yaw. A destroyer at 9 knots definitely rolls. It quite definitely pitches with each wave because it is designed to go through the waves and not over them. And it yaws, which is a sort of corkscrew motion. And so, let me assure you that if you're going at that speed, most of you feel queasy. Unless you've been at sea for about 30 years, everybody feels queasy. And then the weather started getting bad, and we hit the bad weather. I don't think we'd lost a ship until then, but when we hit the bad weather, we scattered, and we scattered over a terrific amount of ocean. Ice came down. The temperature came down, and so the freezing conditions commenced. And we finished up. I have photographs of my destroyer with at least 4 inches of ice all over the decks, over the guns, over the bridge. Even the guardrails around the side were anything up to an inch diameter of solid ice. This was a horrifying experience, basically because there's no ice underneath the destroyer because you're still in the sea, but the sea water temperature was down to about 28. But if you don't get the ice off the top, you could turn turtle, because the spray forming ice on the rigging was... it's a very highly technical thing, but you're changing what is known as your metacentric height, which is the difference in height, a difference in height between your centre of gravity and your centre of mass. And so this is one of the reasons why some of your big ships roll, because they have a high metacentric height, the difference between the centre of gravity and the centre of mass. And with all the ice on the top, you were changing it totally. So we had to get rid of it. So we had steam hoses and chippers and everything going. And at that time, of course, we were also searching for the convoy, which had scattered. And then the Germans started coming over. Our first indication was the Focke-Wulf condors at high level and at high distance circling the convoy coming from airfields in Norway. And these were obviously directing U-boats and also directing bombers, which would be coming over, smaller bombers than these big Focke-Wulf condors, coming over to bomb the convoy. A frightening experience, but not terribly frightening, in the sense that, again, as I say, we were young and enthusiastic, and I think the young, in a way, have no fear. The very young have no fear at all, I find. And we started losing ships. I distinctly remember seeing a tanker going up from presumably a torpedo that had hit it. And that tanker just disappeared from view in a matter of 5, 6, 7 seconds. It just went up in one big ball of flame. Difficult without notes to go into the intricacies of what we lost, but as we neared Murmansk, we had to make a detour right up north to keep away from North Norway, where the bombers were coming from. And I still remember seeing the ice barrier in the distance, which was the Arctic. We were miles above the Arctic Circle, of course, but I could see the ice of the ice barrier where it comes down from the North Pole. And then we turned right and made our way down into Murmansk. And then, horror of horrors, we were attacked by some German, a German submarine attacked us, and then 3 German destroyers attacked us. And they basically tried to attack the Trinidad, which was our covering cruiser. As the Trinidad fired her torpedoes, because in those days cruisers did carry torpedoes, they don't didn't after that. You'll see the reason why. She fired one of her torpedoes, and because of the very freezing conditions, the very low temperature conditions, obviously the gyroscope in the guiding mechanism, steering mechanism of the torpedo had jammed in a particular position. And whilst the Trinidad steamed ahead, the torpedo went in a smart half circle and met the Trinidad when she was about 3 miles further ahead, and so she torpedoed herself. It was thought originally that she had been torpedoed by a German submarine or a German destroyer, but it was proved quite conclusively that she torpedoed herself. And this was a fair panic condition, because here you had a very large ship, something like 12,000 tons, with something like, 800 or 900 men aboard, likely to be sinking in temperatures which were way below normal, down to about 28 degrees Fahrenheit in the sea alone. And we on the Fury and on the Icarus, which was our it was an I class, but I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the Icarus or Impulsive. Anyhow, we circled her in order to see if we could, and put nets over the side to pick up survivors if we had to. We circled her. She was loss of steam, loss of way, loss of everything. So she was stationary in the water, which was very dangerous. But they finally managed to get steam back on one or two boilers, and they did get underway on one screw. I remember that in reading the books afterwards of what actually happened. And the convoy by this time was making its way down into Murmansk, almost unescorted. Finally the Trinidad did manage to get underway, and very slowly and with the escort of the two of us, we managed to get her into Murmansk. But in saying that the temperature of the water was down to 28 degrees Fahrenheit, people don't realise that one of the things on a destroyer is that, first of all, when you're on watch on a destroyer, you are almost open to the elements, because the engine room platform on a destroyer is only about 8 feet below the deck of a destroyer. The engines are so huge, they fill up the hull of the destroyer, and your control platform is only about 8 feet below the deck. So it can be very cold if it's cold outside. And I can distinctly remember being on watch in that engine room in the wool, long johns and heavy long-sleeved vests that had been issued to us in Scapa Flow. My uniform with my roll collar pullover on, and then a duffel coat and fur-lined mittens, standing on watch in an engine room. The main supply of water to the underslung condensers, which took the steam from the turbines, condensed it back to water, put it in the feed tanks, and then the feed tanks supplied the boilers to cool it. The cooling inlets, about 3.5-4 feet diameter, were absolutely covered in ice, and we had to shut off the circulating pumps because it was getting too cold. The water was getting too cold in the condensers. We were worried that we might be getting too cold, and so the water coming in was down at 28 when it's normally, well, anything up to 35, 36 degrees Fahrenheit. Life on a destroyer at that time was pretty grim. We got food when we were lucky. Cooking was a hazardous experience, to say the least of it. And you slept when you could. And so I have perfected almost, even today, 60 years later, I can snooze at a moment's notice. I can lay back in a chair and be fast asleep in a minute, as my wife will confirm. I can actually sleep standing up. I can prove this by standing against a chair and within a minute I am fast asleep. We snatched our sleep when we could. We lived with a life belt around our middle, our pump-up life belts, because you were on a charge if you hadn't got your life belt on. We carried out the minimum of washing, because there was no way you were going to take your clothes off and your life belt and have a shower. And so when people talk about life on a destroyer, and if they served on a destroyer in Arctic convoys, one of the things that is very esoteric as far as people are concerned and is almost the past word is, what do you remember? And one or two people will say, the smell. Because sweaty bodies and no ventilation, because all the portholes would have been deadlight down to ensure that the ship was in no way liable to have a leak anywhere. There was no ventilation as such, and it was just a smell of bodies. And it's one of the things you remember.
When the Trinidad was in danger, were you on deck or down below?
I was actually on off watch for part of the time, and during that time that we were going round, I took photographs of her steaming in her, where she was lying stationary in the water, and we were steaming round her. And I actually have two photographs now of her as she was, with people on deck who had come up from the compartments below deck, wrapped up, waiting to abandon ship. But she finally did not abandon ship, and we got her, escorted her into Murmansk.
Did the Russians give any help to the convoy?
They sent two destroyers out to help us, but we didn't get very much help from the Russians. In fact, it was very difficult and very embarrassing when we were in Murmansk itself. I can only think that they were suspicious of us. We were supplying them with ships loaded to the gunwales and on deck as well, with tanks, with food, with ammunition, with supplies of all types. And yet, the people in Murmansk, whether they had had their orders, and those orders were being overseen by the police authorities and the army, I don't know. But we had precious little assistance. In fact, they refused point blank to even help with the repairs to the Trinidad, which were urgent. I mean, she had a hole in her side which was, I don't know, 18 feet diameter. And bulkheads that had been fractured in her inside her hull. They actually had to send, in the next convoy, the plates to repair the Trinidad. This is all in the book on it, that the Russians gave us very, very little help. The only thing they did give us was black bread, their black bread. And we did have some corned beef, and I think the corned beef came up in a convoy anyhow, and this is one of the reasons why I have never, since 1942, eaten corned beef. I can't face corned beef, because we lived on it. We had it in sandwiches when we couldn't light fires in the galley to have hot food, and when we did have hot food, we had corned beef fritters or corned beef heated up. I can't eat corned beef now at all. I can't face it. But, no, it was a very different... We were in Murmansk, I suppose we were about 3 weeks waiting for next for the convoy that we had taken up to be unloaded. We had precious little of it left. I forget how many ships were left. I'd have to look it up in the records. But I think we started off with about 28 and we finished up in Murmansk with about 12 or 14. But once they were unloaded, we then left Murmansk, and most of them in ballast, because there was nothing to bring back from there, we came back.
How did you spend your time in Murmansk?
Oh, as best we could. We had a regatta on one occasion, I remember. There were about four destroyers up there at that time. Some had been left from a convoy previous to us. And we had a regatta on a fine day, a pulling regatta.